Welcome to Business Therapy, the podcast that explores the intersection of business and mindfulness. In this show, we bring you stories and expert insights on how mindfulness can help you succeed in your career and lead a more fulfilling life. Let's talk about it on Business Therapy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 70 of Business Therapy. Today on the show, we're excited to have Will Sampson with us. Welcome to the show, Will.
Thank you. Awesome. I'm so glad to be here.
Today, Will's going to talk about why it's important, the concept of emotional capitalism, a term, as I understand, that you created, Will. So before we jump right into that, why don't you give us a little bit about your background, where you're coming from, and then we'll jump into the topic.
You bet. So I am in the U.S. I'm in the Virginia area. My background is in, professionally at least, is in the space that's called change management. So historically, what I've done is I've worked with large organizations and helped them go through the change process. But 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago now, I myself had a collapse. I had to create my own burning platform for myself when I had a life crash, and I had to figure out how to go through some significant changes myself. And I was the great beneficiary of some people that said, you know, we're willing to love you and believe in you until you can do that for yourself. It's that concept that I call emotional capitalism. And so now I continue to work with corporations, but I'm also building an individual coaching practice using that concept.
Great. And definitely, if you feel comfortable sharing, we'd love to hear some of the genesis story of your maybe hitting rock bottom moment, or what kind of brought on this life change for you, to what extent you're comfortable sharing.
I am really comfortable sharing, because what I'll share with you, I've told okay. the TEDx audience, so clearly it's out there. So about 3.5 years ago, I entered into the process of recovery from substance abuse. For me, it was alcohol. It could be anything, though. Anything that, what I've discovered through this process is that we often get caught up in these narratives where we think we need something from outside of us to come inside of us for us to feel like we're whole or complete or capable or something. And that was the case for me. I was an executive at a large defense contracting firm here in the DC area. I was, from the outside, looked fairly successful. I have an earned PhD, pretty smart guy, published author, but my internal life was just a chaos and was collapsing. And continuing to drink was really only making that worse. And for me, it was a particular crisis moment. I got my alcoholic behavior got me in trouble with the law, and I had to face a reckoning that I hadn't wanted to face before. And so, you know, oftentimes we recognize that, you know, companies reach certain crisis points, and individuals, we reach crisis points as well. Sometimes we use phrases like the bottom or rock bottom, and I suppose those are helpful for some people. For me, it was just, I got as far as I could with what I had, and I got to the point where I wasn't going to keep going, and I had to figure out how to move forward, and I knew I needed help from a group bigger than me.
Great.
This is of great interest to both Sam and I on multiple levels. What did you find was part of the key to being able to change direction?
Yeah, I would say I can think of multiple ways to answer that question, but probably the single greatest thing that I did was I started to tell myself the truth. Because oftentimes we get caught up, the way I describe it to people that I now have the great privilege of working with people in recovery as well as what I do as a coach. But if you remember the old movie meme, like where the caller's inside the house, remember the old horror film where the caller's actually on the second story in the second floor calling from the landline, you know, and that's what we do to ourselves. So we get caught up in these stories that we tell ourselves. And if we have the capacity to, and if we're brave enough, we can face that story and realize it's just us talking to us about us. Like it's this internal dialogue. I was benefited in part by doing some work with a therapeutic modality called internal family systems therapy, where I kind of realized there were parts in me that were talking to each other and not, they weren't always very kind to each other. So there's a lot of ways, there's a lot of tools and things that I use, but probably the single greatest tool I used that led to recovery and now to some really phenomenal growth is by just being honest with myself about myself.
And was the, and that's beautiful, but like great message. Was the change management expertise before or after this change?
Oh, it was before. So I've been doing change management in the corporate space for about 20 years. My professional background is I was a tech resource. I was a developer. I kind of got as far as I wanted to do in the development space, and then realized that oftentimes the reason why the products we rolled out, and so now we're in the early, you know, first part of the 2000s, in my experience, but oftentimes the reason why those products that we want to roll out to people don't work is because we cared more deeply about the product itself than the people who are being affected by it. And so that was really my entree into change management. What I've been able to do now that I'm sort of in a different space is now I can see, you know, change management for my corporate clients is not just how do we go through these engineering processes and get you from this system to that system, but how do we help your people become different kinds of people so that that you realize your strategic objectives? And that's the same thing that I've had to do for myself.
Would you see some parallels between the approach for change management and getting people to get let go of a narrative and, you know, the journey? Were you able to see it
Absolutely.
At the time?
No. And that's a great question. No, because at the time I was so caught up. First of all, I was caught up in everything that was happening to me. You know, in change management, we often talk about the idea of a burning platform, which is we stole from, there was an oil rig on fire in the 1980s. And the whole concept of a burning platform came out of that idea that sometimes we find ourselves in the middle of an ocean and everything's burning down around us. And all we can think of is how do I get off of this rig, this oil rig? And that was true when I first hit rock bottom, when I had that crash. So I couldn't see it at the time. Now I'm beginning to see that, and now I'm beginning to sort of integrate those ideas, all that learning I've had over the years into the journey that I'm doing. And now I get to reflect it back in the work that I do, both with corporations and with individuals. But no, at the time, there was just no way. I was too caught up in all of the things that were happening to really see the possibilities of what could exist beyond.
Can you just give? I'm sorry, I know we're going a little off topic, but can you give an example, like of how maybe the practice of change management has become much more more meaningful and like the extra dimensions that you've been able to add to it since your experience?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I've added to my practice as a change management professional is this idea of culture and the recognition that we are creating something in our corporations. Oftentimes we think about, well, we're a company that does X. So here in the DC area, there's a lot of companies that provide maybe security services, or they provide tools to the three-letter agencies and so on. Maybe it's Google, we provide search. Maybe it's Salesforce.com. We provide customer, CRM. But that's a byproduct of the culture that they create. And this is kind of one thing that I realized in this process. I realized that the dysfunctions I was putting myself through in terms of my behavior and all that had largely to do with the systems that I chose to participate in and the stories that I chose to tell myself . So as I've kind of thought through, okay, as I'm learning this journey, as I'm learning from this journey in recovery, as I'm learning in my personal growth journey, how can I take that out to people? And one of the big changes in terms of what I do with companies is helping them recognize that you are a company, you create a culture, and that culture then creates something. But if you focus only on the thing you think you create, consulting services, tchotchkes, whatever it is you think you create, if you focus only on that, you will fail in your reinvention. But if instead you focus on what kind of people do we want to become? What kind of culture do we want to create? And is that the kind of culture that can provide these services or these products well? You're going to succeed
and
every
then
time.
Last question, then Sam, I'll let you go back in the direction. And have you been able to infuse that idea of being honest with yourself into the change management process as well? Or the, like,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I had a great experience. I remember this was a couple of years ago when I was sort of early in this process. I had taken on a new client. And oftentimes, those of us who work in the change management field, we come in as consultants. We're rarely sort of on staff at a company. But I came in with a new client, and the executive sponsor asked me a question. And, you know, it was probably week two of my engagement with this client. And in consulting speak, it's often tempting to just make up an answer. If you don't know the answer, make something up. Yeah. And I still remember I told this guy, I said, that's a really great question. I have no idea. I don't know the answer to your question, but let me take that on and figure that out. And I'll come back to you by this time next week with hopefully an answer. And there was another consultant in the mix in the same meeting, and they turned to the next guy and they said, well, what's your answer? And he said, I like wills, you know? So I've been able to really integrate this idea of just the more I'm able to be honest with myself, the more I can live authentically and honestly with everybody around me. I think the big problem we face in living authentically is when we're dishonest with ourselves, when we're willing to tell ourselves things that aren't true, oftentimes telling ourselves things that are just terrible. We often say things to ourselves that we would never say to another human being, even somebody we didn't like. And I find that as I'm more able to be honest with myself, I can then offer that same kind of grace to the people around
me. Love it. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jonathan, you're always acting like you're steering the boat way off course. I have a feeling a lot of what we've talked about up to this point probably is part of the genesis story of this concept of emotional capitalism, because especially the honesty,
absolutely,
the honesty piece is so critical. It's such a critical message, as Jonathan mentioned, from our perspective, for everybody. And piercing the veil of honesty with oneself allows you to practice being more honest with other people.
Right.
And from there spring forth, absolutely, productivity, you know, all the great things and abundance, you know, all the things that people want. It really is a foundation for that. But I guess since we promised we talk about emotional capitalism, before we just dive into honesty and everything else, tell us how this, all the situation, you hitting this life crisis and coming up with all these things, how did it all come up with this concept of emotional capitalism? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So emotional capitalism, like we all understand venture capital. If I'm acting as a venture capitalist, somebody brings an investment to me. They say, here's a product we want to create, a company we want to build. And we would like you to invest money in that financial capital. And then ideally, when I create that company, you know, I'm going to either exit out or I'm going to take it or an IPO the company. And that original investor will get 10x, 20x, 100x in some of the better investments back in financial capital, because we get back what we invest. I started asking this question from my own experience. When I was at my lowest point, I found in the recovery process a group of people who said, let us love you until you can love yourself. Let us believe in you until you can believe in yourself. And I've now been the great beneficiary. I have the advantage of having grown personally because people were willing to do that for me. And so the idea of emotional capitalism started with the question, what would it look like if we saw our interactions with others as ways of investing in them? Oftentimes we hear things like pay it forward, and I think that's helpful to a degree, but it's not so much we have to wait until we get somewhere that we can then help others. The reality is that we are woven together in a chain of interdependence all day, every day. Even when we're asleep, we are living in a system of interdependence, because there's somebody keeping our lights on. There's somebody securing the gate if we live in a gated community. There's somebody, you know, we just live in this world that is bound together by interdependence. And emotional capitalism to me is a way of thinking about how we invest in others on an ongoing basis so that we can see the benefit of sort of giving back and continuing to invest what we've been given.
And before we go further, what strikes me about this, and I'm already starting to like the concepts being developed, but in venture capitalism, for instance, there is this very almost hard-lined energy around getting return. And it's not as much of an altruistic right. vibe to it, I guess. Do you feel like that's an analogy you're developing with this emotional capitalism, or is it different in that way?
No, it's the same, but the difference is that it's harder to measure the return. What it requires is of us is to trust the universe that there will in fact be this return. So I can measure, you know, if I'm investing in a Facebook or a LinkedIn or any of the great tech companies, I can measure that return because I had a spreadsheet or I had a bank balance that said what I started with. I have that same thing that says what I ended with, and I can measure that. I think in order to really be sort of give ourselves over to this idea of investing as emotional capitalists, we really have to trust the universe that that what we give to others will continue to grow, will actually help them grow. It'll help the people around them grow. And it does. It requires us to trust. It requires us to believe in the fundamental goodness of the universe. You know, oftentimes with the people I work with, both in my coaching and also the people I work with who are in recovery, one of the questions I ask a lot is when people are dealing with a particular problem is, how would that problem look if you began to believe that you internally were fundamentally good, the people around you wanted good for you, and the world was aligned to bring goodness to you, regardless of how things might look right now? How would it change if you were willing to accept the goodness of the world and the people around you? And I think in order to really live into this model of emotional capitalism, we have to assume a good universe. We have to assume, you know, that the world is aligned for the good of all. And when we're willing to show up and bring our best into the world and into our interactions, that becomes that kind of investment of love and belief in others.
And do you feel in your experience, you talk about something that I think a lot of people might question, that the universe is fundamentally good. In your experience in working with this model right. and working with others, what is your empirical observation? Does the world seem to be good, or is that something we have to take on faith?
I don't think we need to take it on faith. I think what we need to be is a little more humble about what we actually know. And the problem is that we have all these beliefs about what we know. There's a great line in there's a thing called A Course in Miracles, which is a little bit sort of bordering on religious, and that's not my intention at all. I'm not a particularly religious person, but it says that we are bound to live by the universe we choose to live in. And I think in the same way, I can speak from my own experience that when I treat the others around me, when I assume goodness, that those things that I tend to live in good relationships and I tend to have good things happen. There's nothing magical about it. This whole, you know, we often get caught up, those of us that work in the personal growth space often get caught up in the question of like, what's empirical versus what's mystical? And I think that's the wrong question. The reality is that we're all just trying to understand these things as best as we can. I can tell you from my own experience that when I live as if I'm good, the world is good, and the people around me want my best, even if they're not exactly sure how to do that, that the outcomes tend to be really positive. Not perfect, not, you know, a la-di-da, there's nothing magical about it. I can't manifest $1 million or whatever people think might happen with manifestation, but I have found it to be true that, that I get what I expect. And it's interesting because if you go back into some of the psychological literature in the 50s and the 60s, in the time leading up to the work of, say, a Martin Seligman. So Martin Seligman has been the father of positive psychology. And Seligman has observed that you know, when we bring a positive outlook to life, we tend to find positive things. Same thing with Carol Dweck's work on mindset or Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow. But if you go back only a decade or two before that, there was really strong belief in the psychological literature that that was just craziness. That was just woo-woo insanity. So in some ways, I think we're living in a time where things that seemed incredible or way too far out there, we're starting to see some of the empirical evidence around it. And I don't really even want to speak to that. What I can speak to is in my own experience, when I bring a frame of goodness to the world, I tend to find goodness.
It's very rare that I become the comments on during the podcast cause me to really start reflecting to such an extent that it's hard for me to continue. But this brings up very strongly in me, especially this idea of like, how do you measure like the impact and the like? And to some extent, some people say, how does this become practical, especially let's say in a business setting, et cetera. But I could say unequivocally, most of my life, I had a difficult time accepting anything from anybody. And I was at a very, very low point at one point, and a complete stranger invested in me and literally, I would say, saved my life. That's pretty empirical. Like, you know, like you can, the impact you can have if you, you see the opportunities to invest. And it turned out there was several years later by chance, and you don't look for this, but, or when you give, and he certainly wasn't, I was the only one who could help him with something, in a business setting. Yeah. And, so I've seen in my lifetime, both on the receiving end and on the giving end, the dramatic impact, and I remember those instances far more than any business success at a given moment in time or the like, because this is really what's much more valuable.
Yeah, and there's an interesting parallel to the corporate world, which is that we often don't have the data around this question in the corporate setting because we didn't measure it to begin with. So yeah, if you remember, Wayne Gretzky said we miss 100% of the shots we don't take, right? And oftentimes, like I get brought into a corporation to help them go through a major change and increasingly more and more a cultural change. And my first question is, well, how have you been measuring culture before this? Oh, we thought you would come and tell us how to do that. Well, I can tell you how to do it from this point forward, and I can measure what will be different from this point forward. But because we didn't measure that beforehand, and I work with a lot of tech acquisitions. So I still work primarily in the tech space, and oftentimes I work with tech acquisitions, and it's usually a big company buying small company because they think it's going to speed up their time to market, or they think they're going to save money, or they see some sort of dollar value calculation, but they don't actually measure culture. And invariably, that's why the deals fall apart. So, you know, I had a client, large company. They saw a market opportunity by buying a much smaller company. So he had about a 40-year-old company existing in a gleaming skyscraper, bought a 3-year-old company existing in this guy's garage, and they brought them in. But guess what? The merger didn't work, and within, I think, about a year and a half, they stopped selling that product because the people and the culture that created that product were the key to growing that particular product. And so even in the corporate space, I think this is far more measurable than we give credit for. We just don't tend to do that.
There could be some measurement from like the data they have on employee engagement, because engagement is often a factor of investment. You know, if the employees feel like they're being invested in, especially emotional investment. So,
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And employee engagement is helpful. And that's certainly a key part of what I tend to measure. But I think, you know, from a social scientific perspective, we're actually not very good. We're really good at measuring individual social factors or psychological factors rather, but we're not so good at measuring social factors. I don't know if you know the work of Dan Siegel, I think that's his name. He does the work on interpersonal neurobiology. And he has recognized that the psychological and the social have these interfaces that we just haven't analyzed enough. So I think there's some emerging work there, which is going to be helpful. But it's largely a question we don't ask, so we don't know the answer to it.
And the whole engagement piece too, that Jonathan, I think you're mentioning, you can ask an employee how you feel about the company, but I think from what I'm understanding from you, Will, it's really, what are people's behavior belie about how are they treating each other? What is the actual connectivity and the richness of the network that the company is creating as a container? And there's no, no one's talking about that. No one's measuring it. No one has their finger on it. It's very typical because what I'm struck by in listening to you in this conversation is it doesn't actually even really matter what the product of a company is. If it's going to be sustainable, the product is the product of the culture. It's not somebody's brainchild of what does the market need or want in this given moment. It's kind of, if it's going to live well, it has to be because people are excited and it's because of their interactivity with each other that something beautiful is created. It's not something that you can just force people to make, more or less, if I'm understanding that right.
Absolutely. And I was in the dot-com space in the late 90s, and I actually had one of the companies that crashed and burned then as well. And what I saw a lot of is people looking and they say, well, here's a market opportunity. Let's try to take advantage of that. Not, I care deeply about this thing. Let me help fix it. Let me help create a problem for it. But, you know, and just so many of those companies received these huge valuations and got lots of money, and then they just went out of existence because they themselves and their culture didn't really connect with that issue and therefore with the market. So yeah, I mean, the history is replete with companies that thought they could, you know, find a market opportunity, but no, it tends to be, and even for the ones that may have gotten maybe too big for their own good now, mostly they started because they had a genuine need, they felt a genuine desire to meet a social need.
And the concept of emotional capitalism, then, when you're talking about it, you start talking about it in the individual sense, but when you are teaching or you're trying to put this out in the world, is it company to market interface, intercompany, you know, employee to employee, management to employee, every layer? How do you really try to deploy this?
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely. Every layer, but it always starts from the bottom. It always it builds from the bottom up. So the way you start is by really helping individuals begin to interact with this in this way of thinking, and begin to understand that their actions have the possibility of investing love and belief, or they actually have the possibility of sort of withdrawing some love and belief. Like when we have these negative interactions in corporate settings and even in individual or organizational or nonprofit settings, it's just as likely that we're withdrawing from the emotional bank account as we are depositing. And so when we start from the ground up, and this is even what I do with corporate clients, when we can begin to build a local internal ecosystem, individual to individual, where they recognize this value of emotional capitalism, they begin to invest in each other. Then as we move up, and particularly for tech companies who are looking to be more agile or more nimble in the marketplace, those are not, you know, there's some frameworks out there that help you quote unquote implement agile. But the reality is agile is a characteristic. It's a way of being. And you can't be agile, you can't be nimble if you don't trust each other, if you don't really like each other, if you don't on some level love each other, even if that's just a kind of a brotherly love for each other. And so for me, it really starts with individuals and then it works its way up. But it can also be starting to work with, so I've got one client right now that I'm working with their C-suite and helping implement emotional capitalism within the C-suite itself. And so I'm imagining that that's going to begin to filter down to the rest of the organization because they've taken that value seriously within the leadership of the organization.
And just going back to the engagement, I do think though that some of these surveys, employee surveys, at least uncover, maybe not with precision, but uncover obvious mismatches between corporations or between management and the teams. Like, when the engagement's all the way down on one side, or when the stated mission is not even known by anybody from major corporation, and then some startup is like, we're going to save the world. Like, you already know kind of what you're getting into when you're going to be addressing change management with, you know, with these two groups or, you know, between groups. So,
No, absolutely. I remember I took a qualitative research course in my doctorate, and I remember Dr. Harris, she would say that the greatest value in the data is in the space between the data. And here's what she meant by that. Like we can go in with these sort of Likert scale type engagement surveys on a scale of 1 to 5. How much do you like your job? How much do you trust your coworkers, your employee, your boss, your management structure? Do you think the company aligns with your value? Scale of 1 to 5. And that there's a certain amount of value in that data. But when you add, tell us why, when you add that as an open text box and you allow people to put in, then we're doing what's called sentiment analysis. Then you can go in and say, oh, this person said they like their boss, but we know from their sentiment, they are worried that their boss might know who they were and that they know how they answered, right? When we can get between the data, when we are able to even use qualitative research methods to make more human connections, then I think we have a better chance of beginning it to get at this idea of emotional capitalism, beginning to get at this idea of sort of how we invest in others, because now we're in an ecosystem of humans. We're no longer just a series of process-driven entities interacting with each other to make, you know, to do the things our process description said we should do. Now we're humans talking to each other like humans. And that's a
yeah. And do you feel a part of this? Because I think this is speaking to this revolution we're going through generally, where it has to be more people driven because things are becoming faster and more complex. So in a way, and I'm reflecting back what I'm hearing, companies have to switch mindset almost that you have to create a rich medium of very invested people interactions to create the fertile soil for these very fast, complex things that you want to accomplish to happen properly. And almost have to, it's not, hey, how do I get people to just do what I tell them more efficiently? It's how do I invest in my people so that the efficiency and the outcomes I'm looking for, you have to trust that the people will get them done. And that is a pretty big shift. So absolutely. I guess I can see you being affirmative, but is that kind of what you're seeing in the field at that level?
Absolutely. And so one way you can think about it is that we are moving from engineering problems to design problems. And so I teach at one of the large engineering schools, and I sometimes joke that my job is to teach engineers how to talk to humans, because so often when we approach these problems, and particularly as people move up the management ranks, we desire an engineered outcome because that seems safer and it seems more predictable. But the reality is humans are design thinkers. We're not engineer thinkers. Some of us are more engineering focused than others, but generally human problems are design problems. They're not engineering problems. And we saw this during the pandemic. If we learn nothing else from the pandemic, it is that most of the great problems we face are design problems. And the way this interacts with the question you're asking is, you know, we try to create these sort of predictable, repeatable processes, even in our HR work, which is, this is, you know, take this course and do this and put in this, your annual evaluation, fill out your report, do this. We try to create these processes. And those are helpful to a degree, because if you don't have a certain amount of process, how do you even know what to do? But when we can invite corporations to move beyond the process and actually live into the belief that all the problems they're going to face are design problems. The problem a human is going to face in their corporate ecosystem is probably not exactly like the problem that the last person faced, or the one before that, or the one before that. And so when we can build this way of being truly agile, and that's one of the ironies, because I work with a lot of tech companies, I see a lot of companies that are trying to implement agile in very project management ways of thinking, like very structured, like we're going to do agile. This is the framework for doing agile. And that's crazy talk. I mean, the reality is that being agile is a way of thinking. It means that if I'm agile, it means that whatever problem I face, I believe there's a solution for that. Whatever problem I face, I believe I have a certain sense of personal ownership over it. And that's very different than, do our systems enable us to function with each other? It's just a different kind of question.
When you start with a C-suite, how do you introduce the idea? Like I'm almost imagining like the scene at the end of Jerry Maguire, where like it's clear that there's a connection between, you know, Jerry Maguire and his player, and then there's another coach that is trying to mimic it by giving some awkward hugs. I can imagine you going to the C-suite and say, you have to be invested. Right. And they're like, you know, just like they didn't even know where to put their arms. So like, how does that play out?
Yeah, no, I not only appreciate the question, I sort of live that question quite often. And the way it plays out is I start by modeling the behavior. And so asking questions, being authentic, being vulnerable, that's really the way the process works. And so by modeling for leaders what this kind of vulnerability and authenticity looks like, by modeling for them what it looks like to invest love and belief in them, then over time they start to say, oh, okay, I get it. And sometimes that's 1 month, sometimes that's 6 months, but that's how I approach it. And sometimes it just doesn't work. And the company says, we don't want to do that. We don't want to be vulnerable. We don't want to risk this. And I've found myself out of at least one engagement for that exact reason as well.
Well, we just want the outcome. We don't want all the soft, squishy stuff in between.
Fix the problem.
We want everyone to feel invested in, but we don't want to be emotional.
What buttons do I press to make them love me?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I see that especially with acquisitions. So like the one particular deal or engagement that just was easier for me to leave because I clearly wasn't the person that could fix their problem. They wanted me to help them integrate a company into their corporate ecosystem. And my review of their corporate ecosystem is that they didn't know what it was. And so they weren't even sure what they were inviting people into, other than this person does something cool. And we think if we put it in our product suite, we'll make more money next quarter. Well, that's not going to work. That's going to fail every time. If you have a sense of, and I shouldn't say every time. So because I work in the DC market, like I see a lot of things where, new risks come up. And so particularly for the security agencies, CIA, FBI, NSA, and all that, they often have problems that they need a solution for, that they need something pretty quick and they don't have to think too hard about it. That's the solution. Even things like bot protection, which has come up fairly recently in the last decade or so, companies that were able to create that, were able to create it, were able to find a market space, but that's temporary. That maybe you got 5 years, maybe you got a decade, but you won't really continue to, in growth, we always think about the climbing the S curve and jumping the S curve. You're not going to jump to the next S curve of your growth if you're not creating this ecosystem where people feel like they're contributing.
Yeah, I was going to say, you pulled back your punch a little bit. I would even be so bold to say it fails. It does fail 100% of the time. Like you said, I mean,
it does.
You're talking about building an ecosystem, and the word ecosystem to me is so apt. And you talk about it in the corporate world, but I always think about everything very biologically. It'd be like having a very stable garden and then introducing, let's say, a banana tree in it and saying, I like the way bananas look. It's not going to grow there. It just can't. And people, it's dismissive of things work together in harmony. Things are in balance. You can't introduce elements roughly into systems and expect them to incorporate or integrate just because you want them to. And like you said, I think people have intuition around physical systems, let's say a garden, like the example I just mentioned, but they look at companies and they think, oh, if I just will it, it will happen. But it fails. It fails every time, just as invariably as it would in nature, I'd say.
Absolutely. And people often have those intuitions, even if they're not able to vocalize them. And I think that was one of the great outcomes, not great, but one of the most significant outcomes of the pandemic was people suddenly had this time apart from the office, they're working remotely, and suddenly these things were coming up in their subconscious and coming up to their conscious and saying, oh, I really don't like that way I was working. I really didn't like that way, that place where I worked. I didn't like all these other things. So they intuited it. They knew they weren't happy, but they couldn't figure out exactly why. And the time, that 2-year hiatus we all got from the office, I think caused a lot of people to suddenly bring up those subconscious thoughts into their conscious and say, ugh, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, a lot of those. I just don't want to work, which in the good way, not in like the facetious way, but it's, people acclimate to a lot. And then having that different perspective, I think it really did let a lot of really great stuff out. Yeah.
Following up on the last, do you have a way to early on test if people are serious about making a change? Like, so like as a, you know, because I think like a lot of times people are just like, it's like going to a trainer or going to a gym and like, I'm ready to be thin. And like, no, you're going to have to exercise,
right.
You know, like, right. Like, no, I thought you were just going to make me thin, like do your job, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a great question. And it's something I'm still working on. The answer, the short answer to your question is no, I'm still figuring that out. Because, you know, for 15, 16 years, my work in change management was largely, oh, you want to introduce a new HR information system? Great, I can do that. And oftentimes changes in the corporate setting get relegated to things that people don't really have an option to do or not to do. Like if we're going to introduce a new CRM, a new HR information system, you're either going to use it or you're not going to work here. Like it's just that simple. But these culture changes, I think, are actually much deeper to the success of the organization. But for the reasons I mentioned earlier, because we haven't measured them, it's really difficult to say empirically whether you're the kind of organization that can change. The only thing I can do is when I talk to a sponsor, and oftentimes I'm brought in by CIOs or CTOs, because it's often tech driving the change. You know, all I can do is ask them honest questions and then go based on what they say.
I was just going to say, I feel like you don't give yourself enough credit, because I almost feel like you answered this question earlier in the podcast when you reflected on, can somebody be honest with themselves? Like to from our perspective, volunteer.
Yeah.
If you're going in and assessing whether somebody can make a change, you can almost tell pretty early, is this the kind of person who can be honest about themselves or their organization in a first conversation? If the answer is no, it's almost 100% that they're not going to be able to change from there, I would say.
And yeah, no, absolutely. Good.
I would suggest that a big part of the reason they can't measure it is because they actually don't know what they're measuring by implementing, let's say, the CRM. They don't know what business result other than the CRM was implemented, but not why did we implement the CRM.
Right.
So if they don't know the measure of success and they can't quantify it other than binary, you know, it's implemented or not, you know, what can you graft yourself onto, you know, in terms of a meaningful measurement?
Right. Yeah. I have seen the opposite of this, though, or I've seen the success story here as well, though. So I worked with a client. This was, you know, back before I went through my major transition, but I worked with a client that was seeking to build a mobile workforce. And this was a few years ahead of the pandemic. And we really were able to see significant changes by allowing everyone to work mobily, by allowing them to work anytime, anywhere, any device. By implementing that, we were able to see real changes in behaviors and attitudes and actions. And we saw also significant changes in productivity and significant growth in sales because of that. So there are success stories too, but yeah, you're right. I mean, when meeting with the client, you can usually tell in the first meeting if they're willing to go to that level of honesty and authenticity. And if they're not, then that change is probably not going to happen. That culture change is probably not going to happen. Changing the technology, that's straightforward. I can do that all day long. But changing the culture is where it really requires an organization willing to go through those steps.
It's almost two separate offerings every time, in a way. Yeah, and it's hard for people to see that.
Yep.
Well, one thing I know we're burning time quickly, and we've really only teased, I think, the depth of what emotional capitalism and how it relates to all this. But one thing I definitely wanted to squeeze in was, when you say emotional, I think that word is very consciously picked. And unlike venture capitalism or other types of capitalism where people can intuit, okay, this is finances moving, what is implied by emotion that you're investing? Is it positive energy, positive relationship building? I guess give us a little bit of a take on that, just definitionally.
Yeah, so I'll give you the short answer. The longer answer is to go read Lisa Feldman Barrett's book, How Emotions Are Made. She's a Harvard researcher on emotion. And we create our emotions. Our emotions are not a thing that exists apart from us. We choose which emotions we want to inhabit. We choose which emotions we want to use in our interactions. And so for me, it involves the conscious choice of giving positive energy to others. And often not just the energy in some sort of vague, nondescript way, but literally the words, of, of offering to people, that we are there to support them. We're there to accept them, to believe in them, to believe that they're capable of great things. It's emotion in the sense that it's something we're creating, we're choosing to offer to other people. You know, it's too easy to get caught up in the belief that we're just victims of our emotions throughout the day. That person cut me off and now I'm angry. I didn't get the promotion I thought, or somebody cut me off in line and now I'm sad. You know, whatever. Like, no, none of those things are true. Somebody cuts you off and I choose now to be angry or to accept it as just, I don't know, maybe their wife is sick and they got to get home quickly. Maybe they didn't see me. I don't know. I am in full control over my emotions. The reason why I've chosen it to wrap it into this concept of emotional capitalism is because when I realize that, I suddenly become aware of the fact that I have so much to give. And the most important thing I can give to a person is belief, love. That's far more important than money. There's a lot of, as we mentioned earlier, there's a lot of well-funded companies that have failed. And there's a lot of startups that have succeeded largely because somebody was willing to come alongside that founder and say, I got it, man. You know, sure, I can provide some seed capital or some angel funding, something like that. But I really believe in you deeply. And so I think in the same way, if we were to take that out to our modern corporations, to our relationships, where we recognize that we are in complete control of our emotions and we can choose to invest them in others. And that by doing that, it's going to have an impact on the world in ways we can't fully measure. That's why I chose emotion. I think it's really important for us to see emotions as a resource that we have to use, and in many ways, far more valuable than any money we could invest in people.
That's great. Yeah, I feel like we could talk another several hours about the mechanisms that give such a good yield on that kind of thinking. I can speak, I think, for Jonathan and I both, that we are 100% behind the fact that the more you give that out into the world, you're going to get return every time. And I think it's worth reflecting on. But coming to the end of our time, I wanted to give you one opportunity more. Is there anything you'd want to wrap up with? Also, is there anything you'd like to tell our audience if they want to connect with you? Obviously, you're a wealth of knowledge around the topics that we've discussed. So please, if you have any closing thoughts, we'd love to hear them.
Yeah, you know, sometimes I ask people, particularly people who are trying to come up with a concept that has an impact on the world, you know, what would it look like if we were to imagine the world living that way for the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades? And I think we're at a unique time in our planet. It's easy to look out and see all the devastation and see the dangers and the fears and all the things that we're supposed to be afraid of that are on the front page of pick a paper. But I think we're at a crisis point. Jamie Wheel, who wrote the book Recapture the Rapture, he called it, we're at meaning 3.0. Like, we've had a lot of the things that we created meaning with have collapsed around us. And the most valuable thing we have right now is the emotions that we create and the way they can impact others. And so I guess in summary, I would love for the people listening to this to imagine what it would look like, not tomorrow, not just for next week, not just for next month, for the next decade, 2 decades, 3 decades. What would it look like? How could the world be transformed if we were willing to invest this kind of love and belief in others? And what kind of change could we bring about? So I guess that's my sort of parting encouragement for others. If people are interested in catching up with me, you can find me at willsampson.com. There's a couple different ways to get a hold of me there. And I'm most on LinkedIn, so you can find me on LinkedIn as well.
Well, thank you for coming onto the show and sharing your positivity, your wisdom. It's been a real pleasure. And for those of you tuning into Business Therapy, we really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next week. Thanks so much.